Welcome to the Voices of Homelessness. I am your host, Donald Whitehead, and our show is designed to help you see the real people behind the issue of homelessness. The National Coalition produces this show. The National Coalition is the oldest advocacy organization working exclusively with and on behalf of people experiencing homelessness. I have two amazing guests today. Who are going to tell you a little bit about their journey and kind of where they're at now. We're going to get right into it. There's a lot that we'll discuss in between that's happening. So many things are going on in the world of homelessness and poverty that are detrimental to people. But today we want to hear real stories. And our first guest is Dr. Carmela Daniels, who also serves as the membership chair of the National Coalition for the Homeless. And we also have today Tyler Williamson, actually Mayor Tyler Williamson, who will tell his story as well. And we thank you all for being here. And we'll get right into it. This is an episode I've been waiting to do. So we look forward to you hearing some really powerful testimony about the true nature of homelessness in the United States. So Dr. Daniels, we're gonna go to you first. How are you today?
I am good. Thank you so much for the opportunity to come here and meet with you all this afternoon. I'm doing good, thank you.
Awesome, so we want you to just tell us a little bit about how you got to be the membership chair of the National Coalition. What was the driving force that got you there?
So yes, it's an honor to be able to serve the National Coalition for the Homeless as the membership chair. And how I became involved was I was doing work for the Department of Veteran Affairs for our racial equity, racial justice, veterans homelessness program at that time. And in that work, we were really working with all the VAs across the country to help support those staff and teams to ensure that they are working with BIPOC veterans, meeting their needs, that we were doing the proper assessments. And in that work, I became aware of the National Coalition for the Homeless and wanted to get involved immediately because not only had I served veterans in resolving homelessness, but I myself also had experienced homelessness in my community.
Well, tell us a little bit about that experience.
So when I was finishing my master's degree about 20 years ago, I was in college. I was living in South Florida at the time. And when I had returned back to Ohio, where I am born and raised, I was homeless. I didn't know that at that time that my mom, we had became evicted while I was away at college. And so I didn't have a place to go. She was able to navigate herself, but at that time, it was only her, and I had to figure that out. Luckily, at that time, I had someone who was willing and able to pay for a hotel for me. So that's initially where I landed. But prior to that, I went to our local Department of, Job and Family Services to receive assistance. I never had been in that situation before. I didn't know what to do. I had a master's degree literally in one hand and nowhere to put that. And when I went and met with them, I didn't meet a lot of the criteria. I didn't have any children at the time. It was just a single female. I had no income, but the previous income I had made while I was in school put me over the threshold because, again, you're talking about one dependent person, no children. And they basically told me they couldn't help me. And that was my first glimpse of what it looked like from the perspective of community and being homeless. And there were no lists. There was nothing. I had to really figure that thing out quickly. And again, so someone paid for me to stay in a hotel. I lived in a hotel for about 30 days based on their kindness. And I got a job. And I didn't have a car, and people fed me, and I'm always grateful for that experience and their kindness. At some point while catching the bus, I saw a sign for rent, And again, you're talking about a college student, no experience, minimum income. All I had was, again, a master's degree and something said, well, just, you know, try to apply for this apartment. And all I didn't even have anything to give him. I didn't even have enough money to pay for the application. I gave him my resume and he called me and he said, I'm going to give you this apartment. And I slept on the floor. And one of the darkest moments of my life turned out to be what I used to turn to service to community. So the National Coalition for the Homeless was the perfect landing space for me to be able to serve community in that way. I look back on that time in my life, although brief, long enough. You're talking about winter in Ohio. So you're talking about snow and ice and really just trying to figure that thing out. And I worked then and got hired at the Department of Veteran Affairs and started serving veterans who were experiencing homelessness. And so then I got the experience of seeing homelessness from the federal side and other resources and what was really out there. And then tried to figure out how can we create this same space for civilians in community, because I had lived that experience. And so that is the work that I have continued to do, even participating in documentaries and other things to really bring awareness to homelessness and how it's preventable and how it is not a they problem. It is a we problem. And we collectively need to work to resolve homelessness in our communities.
Well, thank you very much for that powerful testimony. You know, you hit on just so many things, you know, really attacking some pretty deeply rooted stereotypes. I mean, you have education, you have a master's degree and now a doctorate. So it isn't intellect that had anything to do with homelessness, it's circumstances. Mm-hmm. And also, you talked about the willingness to get back into the work. That's one of the challenges we have with this population. Many people, they go through the experience and then they want to get as far away from that trauma as possible so we don't have them and their voices in the advocacy movement. But thank you for staying in the advocacy movement and all the work you've done. I'm going to go next to Mayor Williamson. You know, I was just so taken by your story. We participated in a conference this weekend in New York City. It was around tenant rights. And when I heard Mayor Williamson's story, I said, he's got to be on the podcast. Because we really want people to understand that this is an issue where people come to the issue from many different perspectives, many different backgrounds, and often it's unexpected, the people you meet along this journey. So Mayor Williamson, great to meet you. You are a fantastic presenter. Tell us a little bit about your story.
Thank you, sir. Well, I want to be able to relate a little bit to Dr. Daniels here, because I also, I'm not sure if you still work for the VA, but I work for the VA. So this was not planned, and it shows how maybe there's a lot of intersections as it relates to this conversation, but also, you know, there's the differences in the story. So I love it. And we'll have to find a way of maybe connecting more offline or online in the VA space. So, at the time when I entered my homeless experience, we had been evicted. There was an incident that occurred with my roommates. I had some friends that I was rooming with, and we ended up getting evicted from the unit. My two friends that I was staying with in the rental, they both had family in town, so they were able to like move back in with them and have somebody to stay with while they were trying to create their transition plan. For me, I didn't have any family. I had my friends, and so I my own experience, I was trying not to be a burden on anybody. And so I would stay the night at my friend's house sometimes, but like, I didn't ask for it all the time because I just felt uncomfortable. I didn't feel like I didn't want to be a burden. So, you know, if I did stay at their house, I would like sleep on the floor in my corner. I would like fold everything up nice when I was done, and I wouldn't ask them to even take a shower in their house because I didn't want to be a burden. But like the experience that I had going through that was like not realizing these questions that I wouldn't have thought about otherwise. Like, where am I going to take a shower? Where am I going to go to the bathroom? Where am I going to get a warm meal? The fact that I'm homeless obviously speaks to something about my level of income and inability to be able to get a space that might provide these resources for me. And so, fortunately, I had a membership at the gym. So when I would go to the gym, I would shower there, or sometimes I would go to the gym just to shower. And yeah, it was just a really challenging experience. And I was in community college at the time, so I was going to school full time. I was working two jobs, so I wasn't like unemployed. It's not like I didn't have an income. I just the eviction happened so quickly that between the time that I started searching and actually got a unit, there was a gap of about a month and a half. And so mine was relatively short as well. And then fortunately, I ended up getting a studio apartment that I was able to move into and get myself back on track. But it definitely throws you off. I mean, my ability to be able to focus on my studies and do my work and show up and be present and be like my high energy self, it definitely took a hit. And I can see how this experience of being unhoused can cause people to spiral and end up in a space that doesn't really allow them to get out of it. And similar to Dr. Daniels, like I wasn't that aware of resources, or maybe I knew of them, but I think from my perspective, from my experience, there was a level of shame associated with being homeless. So I didn't even want to present myself in those spaces, because I felt like that made me something that our society looks down very negatively on. And so I never utilized those resources, but now yet here I am as the mayor of Monterey, and we have funding allocated in our budget to support homeless community, and I'm trying to like encourage them to like utilize these resources, because something that's I don't know if it I wouldn't say it's unique, but I think that's something that very much defines the community and the region in which I live in. There's a lot of people that want to jump in and help. And so there's tons of services that are provided. I'm just eager for us to get to a space of really thinking about a housing first model and fully implementing that vision here, because there should be no question about our need and the expectation that we should have of our government to be able to house everybody. So I look forward to
Absolutely.
the rest of the conversation.
And the National Alliance has highlighted your community because you've added lots of housing in your community, and that's a tribute to you, especially in the face of a governor who is kind of enticing people with actual benefits to actually criminalize people. Actually taking money away from communities to criminalize. So I know that the conference we were at this weekend was focused on tenant rights, and I know you do a lot of work along those lines. And I thank both of you for your VA work. I actually was a vi advisor to the Secretary of the VA until this current administration. I have a funny story about why I'm not there now. They basically asked me if I was still doing DEI work, and I said to them as much as possible, and then they told me my services weren't needed anymore. So that just an interesting little piece there. But your work is you've really been instrumental, both of you, in kind of providing new services in your community. Mayor Williamson have really been intricately involved in making sure that tenants have rights. That there is some rent control in your community. Easier, I think, to do that in California. But tell us about that work. And Dr. Daniels, I know you have done a lot of VA work, but tell us about some of the other work that both of you have done in the community and where you see the greatest needs. And you come from two very different communities. Ohio is a red state, and somewhat conservative, although there are good programs there. And California is a blue state, although somewhat conservative based on, how
I was
things
just
have
gonna
been
say.
done recently. California's interesting because it could be four states in one sometimes. So tell us
100%.
about your work and, what you see as greatest needs in both of your communities.
As it relates to renters, I mean, it's a there is a direct correlation between the renter class and those that fall into homelessness. And if I were to try to just provide a quick synopsis for folks in regards to the housing crisis that exists, particularly in California, but I would say across the country, it's a supply and demand issue. So when you have an increase in demand, but you're not increasing the supply, the cost of housing goes up. And what happens is the wealthiest people in a community will continue to outbid each other until the wealthiest person gets the house. And then the people at the bottom get pushed out into homelessness. So it's a really relatively easy formula. I'm oversimplifying it, but for sake of the conversation, that's generally what's created the housing crisis. Now, when you look at the renter class, these are folks that are usually have less income. I mean, some people choose to be renters by choice. They have the option of buying, but they choose not to. But the fair majority of people that are renters are not renters by choice. They're renters because their income does not allow them to be in a space to be able to purchase a property. And so, what we do know, this direct correlation is renters are oftentimes the people that end up falling into homelessness, right? When they can't afford the cost of living, when the unit that they're maybe staying in that is a rental, this is a story that I hear often in our city. A family will come in and decide that they want to move back into the home or they want to do something else with the property. They want to sell it, whatever it might be. And then the cost of the rent goes up and then that person slips into homelessness. So there's the direct correlation there. From a state perspective, I think there's just a lot of challenges. In 2019, well, in 2018, the legislature and Newsom passed a law that was implemented in January of 2019, AB 1482, which was basically statewide rent control and rent stabilization. And so what it says on the rent stabilization piece is you can increase rent every year 5% plus CPI up to 10%. So for the first few years coming out of the pandemic, every year exceeded the 5%, the CPI exceeded 5%. So people were seeing 10% rent increases. And what ended up happening was landlords that maybe didn't increase rent that much said, well, let me go to the limit now, or the maximum, because now if I get into a year where the CPI isn't as high and I need that increase, I won't be limited. So
Can
you.
you explain to our listeners what CPI is?
Sorry. It's the Consumer Price Index, and it's
Right.
based off of the region in which you live in. So the Consumer Price Index is a percentage of how much the cost of goods, a certain amount of goods, increase over a certain period of time. So that's what led to the state level legislation. And so then I think it just kind of begged the question, like, is there a need for us to do more in our local community to make sure that we're protecting renters at the local level? Before I got onto the council, there was no policies that were implemented by the city that actually created protections from the re for renters. So it is all held at the state level. And I do want to just make a little bit of a side point here and say that yes, California is a blue state. And I think a lot of people make assumptions about California and how progressive we are. And I think in some areas we are, particularly on like climate action. But when it comes to this BIPOC or DEI side of things, I think that there's still a lot of work that we need to do. And what affects people the most in their pocketbook? The cost of their housing. And so there was nothing done at the local level. So one of the first things that I did when I got onto the council was ask for a study session on a couple of different policies that I did research on that were found to be things that should be paired together, which included rental inventory program, a rental a rent board and then rent control or rent stabilization. So I presented that, had staff to give a presentation. At the time when I first got onto the council, I was in the minority, so it didn't make it very far. But at least kind of teed up, started having those conversations with the community. And then fortunately, at the end of my term, I ran for mayor, got elected, changed the makeup of the council, now have a majority. So since then, we've implemented a rental inventory program. So we're now charging landlords a fee to provide us data so we can have this database that allows us to make data-driven decisions. Because obviously, rent control, rent stabilization is a very hot button issue. And as opposed to allowing it to be something that's left to partisan bickering on whatever perspective you might have, let's just utilize the data to help drive our policymaking decisions. So we just finished our second year of collecting data. So now we have our first year over year data, and we're seeing upwards of 9-10% rent increases across the city, consistent with what we expected when we saw the implementation of AB 1482. And then the last thing I'll say is that we also created a rental assistance program. So we allocated 250,000 out of our budget to provide rental assistance to tenants. And the reason why this is beneficial is we found that during the pandemic, all of our jurisdictions across the country got funding from the federal government to create emergency rental assistance programs. And the data from that program showed that it actually helped prevent increasing homelessness. So we implemented a program at the local level, and that's been running for about 2 years now, too. And just really thankful that we're able to have some structure around that. Still a lot of work to do, a lot of more conversation to have, especially because 66% of our community are renters. When you actually see the exact opposite in a typical US city. So you usually see 60% being homeowners, 40% renters. But when 66% of our community are tenants and we rarely ever hear from them on the council, that's a problem. So it's like, how do we make sure that we're hearing their voice? Of course, there's a fear of retaliation. I can go down a whole conversation around renters, but the point that I'm making in all this is that there is a direct correlation. If we can keep people housed, particularly renters, that's an overall win for keeping people housed in our community. So.
Really comprehensive overview of kind of some of the stuff that you're doing. A couple of points that are really, I think, critical is as horrible as COVID was, it did teach us some very valuable lessons if we're
100%.
willing to use the data. So important when you're addressing an issue, data is the most important thing in figuring out how to manage that issue. So we know that the easiest way to end homelessness is to prevent it from happening in the first place. And the eviction moratorium and the rental assistance programs, although people say that you can't solve this issue with more resources, we saw clear proof that if you did increase the resources in those two areas as you're doing, it has a dramatic impact on the numbers of people entering into homelessness. I'll talk a little bit more about what you said on about the voice of people not being heard, renters, and also want to talk with both of you about the divide between renters and people experiencing homelessness. Certainly, there's a divide between renters and homeowners, but there's also a divide between renters and people experiencing homelessness. If we could ever find a way to unify those voices, we would absolutely have more of a presence when it comes to voting and elections. Dr.
Absolutely.
Daniels, so you did your work with the VA, and hats off to you again.
Thank you.
The VA has done a much better job than HUD when it comes to homelessness, to be frank. We saw dramatic reductions in homeless veterans across the country, a much more comprehensive approach than we see from HUD. And tell us a little bit about that work. Is that what you're doing now, or are you doing other kinds of work, or?
After the new after the presidential election, then we lost our racial equity, racial justice work, specifically that addressed just how we were even assessing veterans. But in that time, from October of 2023 until that time that work was ended, we were absolutely looking at from California to Alaska to Florida and back of how we were looking at veteran homelessness and how we were just from the core of assessment, the language that we were using. It was impactful work, and we had hundreds of staff that were coming to the racial equity, racial justice calls. Even with Dr. Green, myself, we were just really working to look at how we were addressing our veteran homelessness, how we were just using that language, reminding people of housing first and what that looked like, how our assessments and VI-SPADAT and some of those things were limiting the resources that we were using, and how really on top of trying to house veterans in many states like Philadelphia, there were, there's a battle for somewhere to live, because you're combating with both where civilians are trying to be housed and veterans, and what that looked like, really just addressing things around safety. We even took time during that time, which I still have, to create something called Beyond the Keys. And what it was about was looking at once we housed our veterans or even civilians, once we housed people, how do we keep them housed? What are the skill sets that they need in order to remain housed? It was that work was important to just say we got to do more than just housing people, because that's like one of the steps. It's the first step, it's a big step, but then to make sure that we were changing the recidivism of those who were returning back to shelter or returning and being put at risk for 3-day notices and things of that sort. So Beyond the Keys is the work that we're still trying to make sure that we do, intervening when we can, looking at community resources to see who can help. And so the work that I continue to do is to bring awareness. This weekend, I'll be speaking on youth homelessness in Dayton, Ohio, and what that looks like, how many youth are at risk. We have a shelter that specifically addresses our teenagers, our tweens, young adults. They are at capacity. They are at capacity. Our news just reported that our local nursing homes are, because of all the funding and the cuts, are discharging patients to the local shelter. So now we have an influx of things that we maybe wouldn't be looking at maybe in some of the shelter settings, where we're having higher acuity of care, higher level of care needs that the shelters cannot maintain. They're not able to sustain that. So our need is going to be again around creating space to find affordable housing in our community. Dayton is, like many communities, has a lot of investors who are buying up the rental properties in community. And so when investors are buying that, banks are buying those properties, then the rent is as high as a mortgage, if not higher, depending on what's going on. And you have a lot of single individual persons who even live in my community who can't afford the rent. If you want affordable rent, then sometimes you have to weigh the option of where you're going to live, if you have children, based on community or crime. And so that's where some of that is still continuing going on in our community. The documentary that we did on Evicting the American Dream that's on Amazon addresses many of those things that are going on right here in Dayton, Ohio, and throughout community. And so we still rank at like maybe 50%, again, to Mayor Williams's point about how many renters that we have, right? The renters are extremely high, and many of them are trying to fight for the same apartment. We are building a lot of townhomes, condos in community. It's always going to come down. Can people even afford to do that? Can people afford to live in a one bedroom, $1,500 a month condo? Probably not. Probably not. And even in the best of jobs, when we're looking at those who need benefits or need support, most of those persons are working 40 hours a week. And so we have to acknowledge where our deficits are in community when we're linking that to housing and the potential of people being homeless. One sickness. I'm a single African American woman. I have two children, right? I'm the sole breadwinner of this home. So I could be in any, God forbid, crisis that could stop or generate income. I have two teenagers, right? And so I don't have a community that can come in and pay my mortgage. In that way, I would be considered over resources for everything, absolutely everything. And so it almost goes back, it gives you almost a glimpse of to who I was when I didn't have anything before I became who I am. I'm still in that gap of where you had resources, or you have resources, or these are not available to you because of X, Y, and Z. And so, how do we fill that gap? How do we prevent homelessness? How do we create resources for those who may be working instead of looking at people from a sustain that, oh, you should be able to do this, that, and the other? If our electricity bills are $1,000 a month, how can people afford that? And right, we had an awful winter here in January of this year. Awful. I mean, just awful. And people were snowed in for days here. So electricity and water and all these other things, the bills are extremely high. There's community resources that have tried to help with that and done the best they can. I know they, didn't have enough resources to help and serve everyone. And so in that, we're looking at where our need is to just basically create space so that people can afford the housing, and that we can get some of our landlords to fix up some of the housing, create space that is safe for people. And if the apartment is from 1985, then do we need to be charging rent that you haven't put any of the, updated features in? And just really trying to create this stoppage of slum lords and our banks that are just constantly buying up and just flipping houses, kicking people out. The state of Ohio, any landlord can put anybody that lives in the home on the eviction, including an infant, including a child. So children could be at risk for having an eviction and they haven't even made it to grade school yet. And so we really just want to continue to look at those things. And that's what we're aware of in our community. And that's what we continue to fight.
Well, you both touched on quite a few things. One thing that really you both talked about on two different coasts in the country, well, Midwest and West Coast, is the DEI issue. And we continue to see cutbacks today. We actually saw a Supreme Court decision that's going to undercut the Voting Rights Act in a pretty substantial way. It may not have an effect on this upcoming election, but it will have effect on elections to come. Wanted to talk to you about voting. I know Mayor Williamson, you talked about your lack of party affiliation at the beginning of your career, but how it's gotten more diverse. What are the ways that we can get people involved in the electoral issue in a way that really is making a difference? I think part of why we've seen, and we've seen a ton of cuts. The other thing I heard Dr. Daniels talk about was the people being discharged from nursing homes. That's a direct result of cuts to Medicare. You also have cuts to food stamps, but there's a tremendous amount of cutbacks to public housing, to Section 8 housing, and to homeless programs. And we're being preyed upon almost. People that work or live or exist within the population of people that are under the poverty line. And so how can we make an impact on that? What can we do to get more people to understand and realize how much of a price their ancestors paid to be able to vote? What can we do to get people more involved in that?
100%. Before I get into the voting piece of it, when you brought up public housing, it just triggered another point that I would make in regards to like the perception versus the reality that people have of California. There was legislation passed years back that basically created a restriction around development of additional public housing. And
The
so,
Faircloth Amendment.
yeah. So we have to go through a whole process. We have to put it on the ballot, right? And get support for it. But because again, the perception of public housing, you're creating these barriers to it. And to me, public housing is a good thing. And I think we can do it in a way that allows people of mixed incomes to live in the same space, as opposed to kind of creating this ghetto effect where you're putting all the poor people in one space, right? So how do we integrate people into our community so that we're all living together in the same space? So I just wanted to throw that out, because when you brought up public housing, it's a touch point for me, because I'm all about creating more housing opportunities in the city of Monterey. Regarding the voting piece, to me, I think the most important thing that we can do to get people to engage, it's kind of like this tension that exists in our political values in this country. And we look at things from the perspective of either the individual or a systemic issue. I definitely lean on the side of the looking at it from a systemic, like how are we systemically creating barriers to access? So definitely recognize that there's a need for everybody is entitled to, every citizen's entitled to vote, so they should do that. And I'll give that shout out to folks to encourage them to do that. But like, what are those systemic barriers that exist that prevent people from voting in the first place? And I think one of the things that we're looking at in the city is how do we address issues that impact the renter community? Because once people see that we're actually taking the conversation seriously and that we're really trying to do the work towards addressing their issues and actually implement policies that are making a difference, they'll feel and see that where it's coming from and feel more empowered to come forward and share their voice, right? So I think a big part of it from an elected perspective is people need to have the guts, they need to have the courage to step forward, listen to those voices, create a space where people want to share that story with you. And even if it's not in public, right, like that people feel safe in being able to share their experiences. I'll be at an event and somebody will come up to me. I had a military spouse come up to me and said, our unit, she has a newborn child in her arms, 2 years old. He goes, she said, the child has been in the hospital 3 times because of reactions to the mold that's growing in our house. I've complained to the landlord. The landlord hasn't done anything. What can you do to help me? It's like we should not be having these conversations, right? And so we really need to get our hands around addressing these issues. Now, mind you, this is somebody that's comfortable enough in even saying something. I want to acknowledge the fact that a lot of people aren't going to say anything because they're afraid of fear of retaliation, right? And that's a real thing that we need to acknowledge in the policy discussion around how we address these things and how we create that space for people to come forward, having some level of discretion, anonymity, so that they feel safe and being able to share their viewpoint and perspective. But we need to actually take those steps to show that we're serious about hearing from them, addressing their issues, and we need to actually implement policies that impact their community. And I guarantee that we'll see an increase in participation. So much so that from when I first got onto the council in 2018 to today, we have seen a substantial increase in participation at the city level. And I think part of it had to do with the pandemic. We offered the Zoom option, but even if you look at people that are coming into the chambers, we're seeing an increase. And then on top of that, we have these people calling in that was one of the barriers too for a lot of these folks, right? Some of these people are working multiple jobs, they're taking care of their family. They don't got time to go sit through a whole council meeting. But if you can stay at home, right, have your earpiece in your ear, listening to the meeting so that you can speak during public comment when your item comes up, while you're washing dishes, while you're preparing the lunch for the next day, it makes it a lot easier. So what are you doing to actually change the system to make it easier for those folks that aren't showing up to show up and be able to share their voice?
That's a really important point. And, sometimes voter suppression isn't, changing the laws. It's changing the time at the polling place or the location of the polling place. So there are so many barriers to access that are very subtle that we don't see as much. I mean, of course, when there's a ID provision instituted, then people can point directly to that. They see that it's tangible. But some of those other things you just talked about, and even one of the things we do are you don't need a home to vote campaign. So often we were finding that people were discouraged if they looked a certain way, if they were dressed a certain way, if, God forbid, if they weren't able to take a shower, as you talked about earlier in your story, people were being pushed away from voting places. So there's so many, very prominent issues, but also some issues that are very subtle that we see. But you also said something that really resonated with me, and that's when people see results, which makes me just wonder about the opposite. When people don't see results,
Why am I going to waste my
why aren't they
time?
rushing to the polls and
Why am I going
making
to waste my
sure,
time?
making sure that, if my mayor is voting to arrest one of my relatives who may have lost their job and has to sleep in a car, why would I continue to vote for that person? We can't be one issue candidates. But Dr. Carmella, I wanted to hear from you about voting and your experience in Dayton.
So I think that even in this conversation, we're talking about the lived experience. And what I'm hoping will change with our voting is the lived experience. We are experiencing the lack, if you will, thereof, of the vote. And we're also experiencing the lived experience of the vote. And both of those things are coinciding at the same time. And I'm hoping of that people will understand that the lack for those who didn't vote or felt that, why should I vote? We'll look at where we are now and see I should have voted. I need to be more involved in what's going on because it is vote or die. It is. And that is where it always will lie. And that is where it is going to be. When I get conversations or hear calls about the lack of resources for mental health as a clinical social worker, we know.
Especially in the VA,
Oh, yeah.
they dramatically cut back the mental health services for the VA.
Dramatically. And now we're in war. Who is going to take care of the veterans when they come home from war, right? And so, who is going to take care of the veteran? We're already an inundated system. We're already an inundated system. And I assure you, for those who may not know or those who may listen, that every role is needed in the VA system. It was created for a reason. And then that work is pivotal and important to the success of not only the veteran who has borne the battle, but his widow as well. And so we have worked extremely hard to try to do the best that we can and to build a better system within the VA. But the loss of staff, we will have repercussions of that many years, many, many years to come. And so the voting is going to be so imperative. Many times we think that it doesn't affect us or this doesn't happen in my neighborhood or I'm cool because I have X, Y, and Z. But when you see hundreds of thousands of African American women losing their employment, who many of them are again sole breadwinners of their home or single mothers or maybe just single women living and surviving, when you're looking at DEI, racial equities and racial justice programs being cut, those things were needed in order to better serve community. And folk are not DEI hires. They are serving those who need those resources. And voting is going to be key to that. We just voted our African American, our second African American female mayor here in Dayton, Ohio. And I was, because of where I live, was not able to physically vote for her because of my jurisdiction. But I was boots to the ground to make sure that that people were voting for her, that we need change in our community. And that's important. And so even if we are not able to directly vote, be in a space to influence the vote. Educate people about what's going on in community. People didn't think Project 2025 was a real thing. They believe it now, though. And that was a hard conversation to get us to people to understand, hey, this is what's coming. And sometimes, again, that lived experience, those hard knocks are what really help us to understand, yeah, I needed to vote. I needed to be involved. It hurt me to hear how many people didn't vote because they didn't think it wasn't necessary or it didn't matter. But now those same people, unfortunately, may have lost their income, lost their jobs. Again, what's going on in our nursing facilities? This is going on in this community, in this zip code, and this is important, and it's going on everywhere. But people need to really get out and vote, become educated about what's going to go on. It's not going to always be the way or lean the way that we want it. That's the reality of the world. We have different opinions and we have different thoughts and value systems. But as you said earlier, our ancestors fought and died, literally fought and died to give us the right to vote. And so we have a duty to not just that, but we are ancestors to someone as well. There is someone coming behind us and we need to think about that. We have to get out of our way, our own way, and stop cutting off our nose to spite our face, and really think about how we are going to protect the children that are being born tomorrow, the children that are already born right now. My children are in high school. What the future is going to look like for them. So we are ancestors in our own right. And so we need to look at that. And I think that is what is pivotal when we're talking about how we vote, when we vote, and why we should.
Awesome. And as we wind down, we still have a few more minutes. I'd love to talk solutions. I mean, we have proposed a few things. I hope to do a march in October in D.C. The last time we did it, although it was over 47 years ago, we brought 250,000 people. I'm not under the illusion that we can bring that many people, but I do feel like there is an absence of the issue of housing and poverty in general. I mean, we do see the Poor People's Campaign. We see other, you know, smaller marches, but we haven't penetrated that bubble in Washington that really starts to pay attention to the issue. You've heard kind of, you know, some vague references to affordability, but you haven't really heard people talk about poor people on any platform. You know, what is the solution to that? What do we do? I mean, I know there's not a magic bullet to end homelessness, but how can we at least get homelessness on the radar of our progressive members and members that aren't so progressive? Somebody has to talk about it. And I just wonder if you guys have any ideas being in positions that you're in and also your experience on this issue. What can we do to get this into the forefront of the American conscious?
You want me to start?
Sure.
So first of all, I would say that your idea of doing the march in October is wonderful. I wouldn't sell yourself short. I would try to get as many people there, even surpass the 250,000. Like, I think we got to make sure that we dream big. I understand the need to be realistic, but you know, we have to have that vision in order to make sure, because the benefit of something like that and the conversation that we've been having is whose voice are we hearing and whose voice are we not hearing, and how do we help those that feel voiceless feel that they can be a part of something. And I know you brought this up when we were meeting at the conference this weekend, and one of the things that I was thinking about was how do we do it in a way that works for organizing in today's environment. And what I feel like has been pretty successful are these, like, No Kings marches, and it's very localized, right? And when you get people the opportunity to connect locally, right? So if that's like creating a program where people show up to their city halls in their cities or show up to their state capital, right? Like, how do you help folks organize at the local level? We're all doing it at the same time. We're doing it together so that there's still that collectiveness across the country, but you're allowing folks to look on that hyper-localized piece that I think really has proven to be really successful. I mean, you've seen these crowds. I mean, people are really turning out and showing up to be a part of that. Now, of course, that can't be the end of it, right? You can't just show up to a rally and think that you've done your part.
It's
and
a
I've
tactic.
Always used it as an opportunity to share a message and try to pull people in, right? And show up at city council meetings, right? Like, you have me here because I've been doing great work on the council and I appreciate your acknowledgement of that. But like, I can't do this work alone. It's not me just making these decisions in a silo. And one of the things that I feel like we did it collectively as a country where we failed Obama when he got into office is there was this huge hype around getting him in. And then I think most people were just kind of like, our guy's in, our work here is done, right? And it's like,
We
no,
have overcome.
how do you keep stepping up, stepping forward to help uplift and push those policies forward so that they can be successful? Because now look at the ACA, right? We've seen a rollback of the ACA. Now you're talking about the Voting Rights Act, right? It's just like the slow drip, drip, drip. We need to keep the pressure on. I know that people feel exhausted. It's not for them. But sometimes it just takes one person. Sometimes it takes one person to step forward and do things in a way that might be a little bit different, innovative. And this goes directly to Dr. Daniel's point. It's not about just taking care of us today. We are going to be the ancestors for future generations. And so, how are we setting up future generations for success so they don't have to live through these same experiences that we're going through?
I love that. I love all of that. And, I see the march as a tactic in a larger mobilization movement around poverty. And it's just, when we did this in 1989, we had the faith-based sector, we had the civil rights sector, we had the unions. And so my challenge is to get those people back to the table again. And I think we can do it. You're right. We have to continue to think big, or we're going to end up small. Dr. Daniels, your thoughts about the question?
I think that to the mayor's point, we have to keep going. We can't get up and take our pictures and just sit in space, that we have to make actionable items. We maybe can't drink water out of the fire hose, but we maybe can drink it out of the garden hose, right? Like, we have to make the change and be intentional in the spaces that we have, in the spaces that we can make that change, in the room where we can say something like, hey, we need to think about this systemically, organizationally, community-wide. What can we do that's different? How can I get involved in a way that really brings awareness? I think that, to the mayor's point, that's a great way to think about it, is just one bite at a time, but consistently doing that. It's not a wipe of the hands, because again, there is someone coming behind us. We may have resolved homelessness over here today, but there's still something coming on over there. We need to look at our teams that are working and serving. They're inundated. We just did point in time in Ohio, which that may look different, of course, in different areas. And there are people living not even 10 minutes from my home and up in the woods. I had no idea. I drive past it every single day, deep in the woods. My heart went out to that. And so it's not just, okay, I'll see y'all in January. I'll be back next January. It is, how do we do this again? How do we really resolve homelessness? How do we get those persons out of those encampments and into shelter or safety or housing, so that they can be sustainable? It's beyond the keys. It is looking at not just those who are housed, but those who are at risk for being or losing their housing, and really the best way to address that. So again, constantly keeping that message out there at the forefront. The work is never going to be done until homelessness is completely resolved. And it doesn't just say, oh, Dayton is good, so we ain't got to worry about California. No, it's everywhere. It's everywhere that is at risk. And we need to continue to fight.
I just wanted to say real quick, Dr. Daniels, I never heard the one where drinking out of a straw instead of a fire hose. I like that. The one that I heard that's somewhat related is instead of taking the fire hose straight on, you just kind of move to the side and take the little bit that you can, right? But it's about doing what you can and keeping that energy going. So I appreciate you sharing that.
I also appreciate both of you talking about it in terms of generational movements, right? I think of it as a relay race, right? We had our fathers and uncles and mothers and aunts in the 60s and 70s, and they marched, and they were the first leg of the relay. And then we're the next leg. Our legacy, this is our time. This is where we make a difference as a generation, or multiple generations. But I remember a conversation with Martin Luther King III when he told me that his father believed that homelessness was the unfinished business of the civil rights movement. And so we have to finish the job because right now we're going in the opposite direction. And so it's up to us to do whatever we can to be the somebody that makes the change. I have a little story about that. I won't share it because we don't have much time left, but I want to give you both 1 minute to close us out. This is the Voices of Homelessness. We want to hear your voice on what you your closing thoughts before we end the show today, sir.
I'll succeed to the mayor first, if that's okay.
You're giving back your time, right?
As we had this last conversation, this last piece of like how we do the work, how do we create that opportunity? I think a big part of it is coalition building, right? Like this right here, like Dr. Daniels, I need to know you more, right? Like I feel like we need to connect more and help support and uplift the work that we're doing, because when you build these coalitions and when we help support each other, it just makes it a little bit easier. You know, you're not doing it by yourself. And it kind of was like reflective me thinking about this conference that we attended this past weekend around renter protections. It's like, wow, this experience of being able to hear what people are going through in other parts of the country, how our experiences are, there are similarities there, but also the uniqueness of our communities and what makes them different. So it just made me feel really empowered about the work that we're doing in our community. And I would just say, in as much as you can, keep that energy alive, keep it going, help support each other, bring more people into the fold. We're only stronger together. And we need to make the change because people are hurting, people are dying, like people's lives are on the line. And it's oftentimes an afterthought. And it's unfortunate that folks that are homeless oftentimes get put into this, cast into this bucket. That they're less than, and they're completely worthy. They deserve all the support and help in the world. Housing is a human right, and we don't need to use that as a catchphrase. We need to actually live up to it. So, thank you, Donald, for the invitation to be on here, and it was a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Daniels, today.
Thank you.
Dr. Daniels, last word.
I always tell my social work students, we are never far removed from the systems in which we help others navigate. And so with that, I will say that homelessness is a we problem and that we need to stay focused on that. And though I may sleep at night with a roof over my head, there are millions who do not do that. And I do not take a night where I don't think of them. And so again, I fight this battle. And I want others to stay involved in this battle because, again, we are never far removed from the systems in which we help others navigate. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to come here and share a little bit about my journey, and what I want to do and will do, going forward.
Thank you so much. We couldn't have ended on a higher note. Thank you, Dr. Daniels and Mayor Williamson. The viewer, thank you so much for being with us. This has been the Voices of Homelessness, and it is produced by the National Coalition for the Homeless. We thank our producer, director, Kalita Harris, for her fine work, and we wish all of you the best of luck. We hope that you can navigate through all of these horrible changes that we're seeing, and we hope you'll continue to listen to the voices of homelessness.